Fork Tales, a podcast that feeds ideas to the food and beverage world. Fork Tales is brought to you by Vigor, a branding and advertising agency focused on the restaurant and hospitality industry, and by Quench, a food and beverage advertising agency that specializes in evolving iconic food and beverage brands. Learn more, visit vigorbranding.com and quenchagency.com. If you love what we're serving up, please give Fork Tales a 5-star review on your podcast service of choice. Think of it as a tip for good service.
Today's guest is an absolute force of nature. She's got an engineering degree from Columbia, crushed it on Wall Street, then pivoted to culinary school, graduating first in her class at the French Culinary Institute. You're an Iron Chef, a Food Network star, and a best-selling cookbook author. Today, she's the founder of Soulbird. We're going to talk a lot about that, where she's serving up some of the best Korean fried chicken on the planet. She's amazing and talented, Judy Ju. Judy, welcome to Fork Tales, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, it was great. I got to meet you, I believe it was in Fort Worth not too long ago, right? We were at a food and beverage roundtable.
Yeah.
And I'm blown away by your story, and I can't wait to hear all about the history. And I mean, I guess the big question is, why would somebody with all these degrees decide to start restaurants?
Yeah, I don't know, right? It's like one of the hardest businesses in the world, as you know, right? And it's challenging. It's different every single day. There's chaos around every single corner. But we love it. We're hospitality people. And, you know, I love creating experiences. I love creating meals. I love food. I love the language of food. You know, it is a language of love for me. And I've just got so much passion around it. And, you know, I didn't have that kind of passion around Wall Street. I mean, believe me, I liked making money. Everybody liked money. But, you know, it's different when, you know, it's like money was growing on trees back then. It was very much the Wolf of Wall Street days. And I'm like, I'm going to downgrade my life in every way possible and work, you know, weekends and evenings and right. much longer hours can pay the fraction of what I was getting.
There you go. that's a true restaurateur right there. I like it.
That was a grand plan, right?
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Well, so, you know, you moved into banking with Morgan Stanley, Goldman, and then, you know, you have an engineering degree. So how did that transition to food? So how did you go from those places, Columbia and all of that, to the transition into food?
Well, gosh, it's... you know, it's a very serendipitous route. I didn't plan this. It just kind of happened. You know, I mean, I always dreamt about doing something in the creative field, but I didn't really know if that was possible. You know, I had a really typical tiger parent upbringing. You know, Korean immigrant parents, and I was supposed to be a doctor. All of this jazz, and you know, was kind of the dumb one in the family, having only gone to Columbia, and everybody right, else has gone to, you know, like the Yales of the world and et cetera. And so, you know, becoming an engineer was kind of an accident, I would have to say. I was always better in math and science all through mm-hmm. high school and everything. And plus both my parents are in the sciences, my father's physician. And back then, Columbia University's application was one page, and it was the same for Columbia College, a liberal arts school, and also the School of Engineering. And there was a little checkbox on the upper right-hand corner, literally a tick box. It said Columbia College or School of Engineering. And I remember hesitating, like, which one do I want to do? It was like, and I was like, oh, math and science is easy for me. I'll go to engineering school. I didn't really, it was kind of crazy. I didn't really think about it too much. And then I get to engineering school. It's like, gosh, this is hard. I can't be an engineer, you know? And then everybody was going into finance. So I was just like one of the minions and lemmings that's kind of ended up in finance and did my analyst program and everything. And, you know, was having a lot of fun. Those are the days when, you know, you couldn't go out enough and you couldn't spend enough money and expense accounts were through the roof. And mm-hmm. it was crazy. It was a pre-Me Too time of era also and all of that stuff. And I worked real a lot. You worked really hard. Mm-hmm. Back then, you were supposed to work hard, and especially mm-hmm. when you were young. And it was literally 90-hour weeks, if not more. You know, 3 a.m. was a good night. That was a Saturday night. You know, right. And it was quite normal. You were doing everything and everything to get ahead of the people sitting next to you and just working longer hours and more and just, I don't know, it was crazy. But I didn't have a passion for it. And I just kind of, you know, I was working. I also moved out to San Francisco and was working New York market hours on the West Coast, which was brutal. Really brutal. So you're in the office, you know, at 3 a.m. practically. And, and you know, I got engaged to a guy and he's now my ex-husband. funny how life surprises you, but it was a good thing in the end. But he was just like, you know, why don't you just do what you love? And don't worry about it too much. And for me, I was like, okay, I just want to go into food and cooking in this wild, crazy world. And I quit my high-flying Wall Street job and enrolled in cooking school at the FCI. And I kind of thought, you know, that would mean I would have really cool birthday parties for my kids or something. I had no idea. Like I didn't really plan this, you know, ended up not having kids, getting divorced. And, you know, I guess like just really like paving my own way through this whole, whole industry and not knowing what was, you know, going to happen, but forging a path, you know, especially as a minority female, it's not easy trying to, you know, get on TV. And especially this is like way before the Korean wave. This is before this is before any of that,
you know, K-pop,
all of that, but before any wokeness, I don't even know if I can say that word anymore, but, and so it was hard, but, you know, I managed to find a path, you know, and that, you know, Iron Chef of UK, my own show, Korean Food Made Simple, you know, books. I'm a regular on Food Network. I have a show right now, House of Knives, that's on Food Network. And, you know, and restaurants, I never really thought it would lead to this, but, you know, it's... It just, you work at it. There's a lot of failure, but you keep, you know, dusting yourself off and trying to figure it out. And the goal, I guess, is to exit one day. And so we'll see. I mean, like we're watching the Wingstop founder talk. And so that's kind of the dream, right?
You're that's right. Dreams. Well, it's funny because it'll happen. I mean, you have too much energy and your personality precedes you. I mean, you're definitely engaging. You tell you have passion for what you do. And, you know, it's funny, like I've two daughters and I just told them like, you know, if you find something in life that you love, you don't work a day in your life. And you know, it's sort of true. It really does help get through the hard days because you do work. We all work. But I think the entrepreneurial spirit and having a passion or being able to apply it to something you're passionate about, I think is a key. And I think it can be a differentiator. So, I mean, obviously you found your way and that's awesome. How did did the engineering and the banking, how did that help you with restaurant management? I mean, I'm sure there's some corollaries.
Everything. Yeah. Every single job, I mean, like the engineering, I was an operations research major, industrial engineering operations research. It is all about operations.
Right.
Restaurants is all ops. Ops are key, particularly if you're doing what I'm doing, which I'm in the fast casual quick serve space, you know? Mm-hmm. So it is all about honing and hammering down your operations. And I don't care even if you're doing three Michelin stars, you have to have ops in place.
Yep.
Front of house, back of house journey, customer journey, all of that, you know? Like where you put the waiter stations, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like where do the dirties go? How do people come out? Like what section does this dish come off of? Like what areas? It's all about operation design and efficiency flow. And then, you know, all of that also engineering is also goes hand in hand with designing restaurants. You know, I did a lot of classes also in human factors and also material science. So you just have to. And so like, I'm constantly arguing with my architect because I'm like, is that durable? Is that going to stain? Is that keep it clean? Is this going to chip? Is this going to, you know what I mean? Because they don't care.
They just want to look cool.
Exactly. And like, they don't care how easy it is to clean or whatever. They're not cleaning it. Like, you know, and so I'm constantly using my engineering degree everywhere. And then business and finance, you know, thank God I can speak that language also because it's part of restaurants. A restaurant is a business at the end of the day.
Oh,
and
of course.
I know so many restaurants that have had Michelin stars that go bankrupt, you know, and It's at the end of the day, you have to be able to know cost control. You have to be able to, you know, maximize profits. You have to understand the business and the finance of a restaurant. And also part of that is also going out and getting money and raising money.
Sure.
You know, so to be able to do a business model and to forecast and all of that and to understand what that means. Like if you've got one less seat in the restaurant, what does that impact on the bottom line? You know, if you're open two more hours, what does that mean? You know, and so I feel like I am wearing every single hat that I've ever put on in my previous life. Well,
That's exciting, right? I mean, so like what I think is really kind of a neat corollary. I mean, I own advertising agencies, and I'll say similarly to a lot of restaurateurs, I started off as a creative. You know, a lot of restaurateurs start off as a chef, right? And I learned very quickly that I better figure out this business side of things, this operational side of things, because just because I can make cool stuff or come up with great ideas or great ads or whatever, that's not enough. I mean, someone's got to, you know, you got to farm it, you got to put it together, the operationalize, you got to make money and make a profit. So you're coming at it from, well, you have obviously both powers. I mean, you have the creative power and you also have the business intelligence power. So that's a fantastic thing, because, you know, to this day, I mean, we have our Vigors, our restaurant agency that does all focus on restaurants, and we have Quench, which is all CPG food and beverage. We do lots of national brands. But to this day, operations is probably something I talk about more than I do about my clients, about creative and everything else. It's about the business of the people and everything else. So I totally empathize. And I also understand that, you know, when you run a creative business, it really does help to have that expertise, and you have it all, I guess. So that's fantastic. It's very cool.
Well, I could also describe myself as jack of all trades, master of none. <I don't
know. laughs> Wow, that's not true. Come on.
The thing is, you have to understand a bit, because I know so many chefs who can't even get their way around an Excel spreadsheet.
Sure.
You know, and it really helps. You know, and because like I have higher education, you know, and a lot of chefs, particularly in Europe, because Europe tends to be a little bit more vocational, just you know, being able to write a recipe and delivering it to an editor, you know, for publication that doesn't need a lot of editing, you know what I mean?
Right.
And to read a teleprompter on the first try. These are all skills, you know, to
Come
up with like witty, pithy commentary on the spot, you know, just with somewhat of a rich vocabulary when it comes to describing food. Like these are all skill sets that have kind of, you know, managed to find their way into helping me become successful in this.
We said earlier in our conversation, okay, you know, a woman owned business. You're in these businesses that are so male dominant. There's an article that was written about you in the Wall Street Journal. Talk a little bit about that. These, you know, banking, engineering, and now restaurateur. What's it like, you know, doing it on your own?
Yeah. I remember I had an internship in New Jersey at a place called Bell Labs. That was one of my first internships when I was thinking of becoming an engineer and also a science nerd. And I asked to go to the bathroom and was so Hidden Figures. All these guys looked at me and they had no idea where the women's bathroom was. Because I was literally the only female working the entire building. And they had to walk me over to like the main building that had the auditorium. And so, and when they had the auditorium, they had a women's bathroom.
That's funny.
Yeah. So, and then I was in finance, you know, and then also engineering school back then. I think we were, I don't know, like maybe like 20%, maybe less, like 13% women or something like that. There weren't a lot of girls in the engineering school. And then I went into finance, and not only was I in finance, I was on the trading floor. So it was like the pit, you know, of like 500 people just all yelling and screaming. And I was the only female professional in my group for a long time, you know, but there weren't that many women at all.
Yeah, I'm sure.
A handful of us. This is again, like this is 97 to 2003. So this is a while ago.
Yeah.
And then I go into kitchens. I'm a glutton for punishment. Again, you know, like not a lot of women at all. And it's been an interesting journey. You know, I've never thought about it that much. ironically, I went to an all-girls school from, from kindergarten to 12th grade. So I think maybe that's part of why I'll just never, you know, like, I was just like, I'm just going to speak. I'm going to raise my hand. I mean, I was asking all the questions at the conference, you know what I mean? I'm like, I don't care. I'm just going to
ask great.
And whatever. You know, I just, I guess I kind of, I don't know if it's this fearlessness or I just don't care or like, or it's almost like, I don't know, I guess it is a lot of part of being an entrepreneur, because when you're an entrepreneur, you just put yourself out there, you know,
have to.
And
that's right.
You have to. And if I want to be in these industries where I am the one and only minority, when I'm the one and only female, you know what? I don't care. Like, I'm just going to.
Do it.
I'm just going to do it. You know what I mean? And if I can make my way, and sure, it's a little bit harder, but I find that most industries are male dominated. It doesn't matter if you are, you know, even in hospitals, like doctors, yes, they're female doctors, but their majority are male doctors, majority of surgeons are, I mean, it's changing, but you know, even in law firms, like I have friends who are like the one and only single female partner in their entire global law firms, you know, banking for sure. Finance for sure. You know? So there are a ton of male dominated industries. YPO, where we met. I mean, how many women were in that entire conference?
Not enough. Not enough.
Less than 10, I think.
And it's way better than it was. That's the thing. Yes. Way better, but still not enough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, actually, you know, Marlo was, you know, arranged the entire thing. And me, Marlo, and one other female YPO were standing by the elevator, waiting for the elevator. And a guy comes over and he I don't know, he was a little bit drunk, but he was just like, he's like, are you guys the admins? You know? And then we're like, no, we're the YPOers. And then Marlo just kind of rolled her eyes at him and just, but it's, I guess that's just the.
Yeah, it's a shame, like, but that doesn't surprise me.
Statistically, right? Like all the admins there were females.
Right.
There were probably more admins there than there were women YPO.
That's a good point. You're right.
It's kind of,
Well, so let's jump into now the food stuff. So before you founded Soulbird, your restaurant, we're going to talk about that in a little bit. You worked in a lot of restaurants. So, you know, the schooling, the engineering, all the bank finance, you got into like some of Gordon Ramsay's locations, became a fixture in the Food Network. Talk about like where you worked in the restaurant business, and then how did you slide into TV? I mean, that's another thing. It's because you're going from here to TV now. I know it's tied to food, but like talk about that.
So, I started actually working in food media. So I was working at Saveur magazine. Mm-hmm. I worked for a nonprofit called Slow Food USA for a while. I worked, Time Out when that was a magazine. If you remember when Time Out was a magazine, you know, so I was doing a lot of food writing and recipe development, editorial, et cetera. And then when I hopped the pond to London, I started working in the Gordon Ramsay restaurants and Empire. So I started in a 3-star, and then I moved around and rotated into Maze, Petrus. Most of these restaurants have closed now, Boxwood Cafe, et cetera. Claridge's, they literally no longer exist. Except for his 3-star restaurant. And then I also started, I did stages. That's kind of when you do apprenticeships. So I did stage at another 3-star called the Fat Duck. I also did a stage at the French Laundry with Thomas Keller here stateside, as well as a Michelin-starred restaurant in Bangkok called Nam. So, kind of did a bit in the fine dining area for sure. And then I was doing a bit of television here and there just because, like, I mean, I had met some people and I was doing Korean food and, you know, they wanted like more ethnic cuisine on TV and women. And so I started cooking on a show that was run by Optimum Television called Market Kitchen. It was one of the big food shows on television at the time in the UK. And then everybody knows each other in the industry. And then Iron Chef came up, and then the castings came up, and I was casting call after casting call after casting call. Didn't think I had a chance in the world, and then ended up landing that gig. And then the guys who did Iron Chef in America, you know, they had like, I don't know, 30, 40 seasons of that or whatever. They came over to consult for Iron Chef UK, saw me, liked me, started bringing me over to the US to do more work with Iron Chef as well as Food Network as a whole. And then that led to my own show, Korean Food Made Simple, which had 2 seasons, also a book. And yeah, and the rest is kind of history. And then my own restaurants called Jinju after that. And I had two in London and one in Hong Kong, stepped away from that brand in 2019 and then started Soulbird, which now has 7 locations.
Yeah. Fantastic. So what impact did, you know, being TV chef have on your career? Like, did it help? I mean, what are the impacts?
It always helps. Your profile is just raised tremendously.
Build the brand.
Yeah, the brand. So that is part of the brand. Same with the books, things like this podcast, you know what I mean? Just like building the brand.
That's
and constantly working on that, you know, and hopefully, you know, it fuels the Soulbird brand and everything else. And yeah. So
if you had to choose between the being a TV chef and like a real quote unquote chef being like, you know, the Soulbird, what do you like? I mean, obviously you own the restaurant, but do you like, if you just, would you rather be just a chef or would you rather be a TV chef? What's more, what are the differences?
Different, you know, yeah. And people who only do one or the other, there are people who, you know, there are people like Ina Garten or who they only do TV, like they don't do real restaurants, right?
Right.
There are lots of just television only chefs. For whatever reason, the men tend to bridge that more. They're television chefs and they actually own and operate their own restaurants. There are only like a handful of women who actually do that. It's like me, Alex Guarnicelli, Esther Choi, just trying to think of, and closed her restaurants, Anne Burrell, just trying to think of other female chefs that are kind of, you know,
once again, you're breaking down barriers and doing, you know, going on your own. It's crazy.
Yeah. So
it's awesome.
Well, it's hard, but I mean, television chefing is just much easier because the hours are easy.
Oh, I'm sure.
And you're not working every single night and every single weekend and you're in a nice air conditioned studio versus like, you know, burning yourself and you know, in hot,
having people complain and deal with employees and
running a restaurant is full of a lot of headaches, you know. Like television chefing is much easier. Much easier.
If I had the chance, I would have rather been on Mad Men than running an agency, that's for
sure.
Definitely.
That'd be more fun, right?
Yeah, a lot more fun.
Exactly.
So let's talk about your newest adventure, Soulbird. All right. Tell us a little bit about Soulbird. I'm intrigued because it seems like you're in a lot of like sporting venues and just sort of like not standalone restaurants. You're in venues. Is that, I'm sure it's obviously a part of your strategy. So talk a little bit about Soulbird, how you created it and what's behind it.
So we are looking for more traditional spaces right now. So that's definitely on the map. And I'm going to start down the journey of franchising also. But
excellent.
They're all licensed deals. So it's like a three-pronged approach to terms of growth. Definitely need some more standalone locations. So there's been a lot of kind of, I guess, turmoil in the UK, to put it lightly, and even more so to come. I think there's a lot of turmoil in the U.S. these days, too.
As we're recording this, there's a lot of turmoil, yes.
Exactly. And so, you know, we're looking at sites, working with real estate agents, et cetera, just trying to get, just find the right locations. But we're definitely looking to grow, and franchising is a big part of that strategy. Well,
you're in London, New York, Vegas. You have several locations in New York, right?
Yeah. So we're in the arenas in New York. We're in the Aria in Las Vegas. We're in Shepherd's Bush Westfield Mall in London, and also Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, and also Edinburgh Airport.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
And so if I may ask, what is the reason for those? Well, they're high traffic, obviously, but is it really almost a test and learn, like to get this and then to do more of the standalones or destinations?
You know, they were an easy way for us to grow without putting up too much capital, right? And they're pretty much one trick ponies, especially the arenas. It's just like two things on the menu. This is high volume, high speed type of stuff. We like the space because we like when people are forced to order and to eat our food with its captive audience. This is why airports are great too.
Yeah, sure.
The airport menu, that's a real restaurant. We got like 75 covers or something like that.
Wow.
You know, in that one. That one's a beautiful, real restaurant. But it's a great model for us. Like I like the arenas. I think they're fun. There's a fun factor. And you know, when you're only doing like one or two items, it should be doable. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about, I mean, Soulbird, I mean, spelled S E O U L. So for Seoul, Korea, I mean, talk about the chicken, talk about the whole inspiration behind it.
So Korean fried chicken is a separate thing, as you know. It's different than Southern fried chicken, Nashville fried chicken, Dave's hot chicken, all of that other stuff, Popeyes, Chick-fil-A, and that. It's a twice fried product. So it's also thin and crispy, and usually it's a wet batter. So fried chicken came over to Korea with the GI presence, you know, from the war. It's not something that was traditionally Korean. It was loved by the locals. It stuck like a vengeance. It evolved and it changed. And I tend to feel that the influence of tempura, you know, of the frying of that wet batter came in to a thinner crust, light and crispy, but like very, very like kind of like almost like a shatter crust. And so like Koreans like things that are extra crunchy, right? And so it's also been nicknamed like stained glass chicken or like eggshell chicken or something, because you're looking for that crispy crunch. And that comes from a double frying technique, comes from a traditional wet batter technique also. And then the other thing that makes it different is the sauces. So Korean fried chicken traditionally will come pre-coated in a sauce. So something that is spicy based on gochujang. Gochujang is a fermented chili paste that is full of spice. It's red. It's fiery. Also has a bit of sweetness. I think it's a little bit fruity. It's not too spicy though. It's very balanced. It doesn't blow your head off. And then you can also choose probably like a more soy garlic ginger based sauce also. But there are sauces, you know, like 25 different sauces that you can get it in. But the ones that the Korean fried chicken is most famous for are the ones that are really grounded in those fermented umami flavors like soy sauce and gochujang.
Well, I know like we do at Quench, we do food trends every year. And I just presented our annual food trends to the National Refrigerated and Frozen Food Association yesterday. And one of them is, we call it swicey, which is sweet and spicy. So, you know, that's just right. It's right down the barrel there. That's like right on trend. And
I'm sure Korean food is on trend. Oh, yeah. It has been for a while.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the flavors. I mean, I went through a list of all the millennials, the Gen Z, everybody wants to try new things, and they're really open to all the social media. So it's sort of like, I want to be the first to try a new flavor from a different country so I can be the one to say I found it first. And so it becomes this very like Instagrammable moment, right? Which is cool.
Yeah.
So I read an interesting statistic that there's more fried chicken locations in Korea than there are McDonald's in the entire world.
I've heard that too.
Yeah. And there's 41,000 McDonald's in the world. So that's an awful lot of fried chicken places in one country. So obviously it's taken hold.
It is. Yeah. Koreans are obsessed with fried chicken. Obsessed. Yeah.
So that's great. So how do you strike the balance between staying authentic to those flavors and adapting these new menus? Because I have to imagine, especially with the places you're being, you want this to, you want a franchise, you want this to catch on, you want this to be a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, like the word authentic is such a loaded question right now, because I always believe that today's invention is tomorrow's tradition. I mean, look at Korean fried chicken. That is not something that my grandparents necessarily grew up eating, you know, that is something that came to Korea through, migration of people and war, right? Because of war. And then, you know, it was adapted by the local people, evolved, and then boomeranged back around the world as a uniquely Korean product, you know? So is that authentic? Not really, but, you know, and immigration patterns are, you know, a testament to this too. But I think it is authentic, you know, because it's something that has been born out of, you know, immigration patterns or workers or war or something. And it's become its own thing. So, you know, like Chinese Korean cuisine is its own thing. Right. And that's authentic too. What I would like to say for, something being authentic is that it still keeps its DNA and its taste. Like there are definitely certain tastes that are just universally ubiquitously Korean. Like I taste that gochujang, or I taste that roasted sesame oil, or all that hit of garlic. And there's certain tastes and flavors that are Thai, you know what I mean?
Right.
And so, right? And just the spices and the flavor profiles and the traditional aromatics that they're using. So I like to say, just as long as like the DNA is there, you know, but that makes it Korean. But it's a lot of Korean American cuisine. I think it's its own thing too. And, you know, I think it's fun to change up food and to make new inventions and
I think it's great.
Challenge the public, you know. And one thing that we're seeing actually is that, like, I didn't predict this, was that, like, people are eating our fried chicken just on plain rice. Like, mm-hmm. they'll order, you know, fried chicken, and then they'll just order a bowl of rice, and then, like, and have some, like, yeah, so just fried chicken and rice, and then that's it, yeah, which I think is, yeah.
Well, I think the product, I think the whole concept is so on trend. I mean, look, we've seen the explosion of all the different types of chicken. And like you said, yours is not like everyone else's. So with the desire for this spicy and the desire for international flavors and the fact that it's fried chicken, I think you're hitting all the cues.
Yeah, and, we're trying to. Yeah. Well, like, we're also with Soulbird, you know, like, we're very much leaning into like the Korean street food part of it too. So yeah. We have japchae noodles. We have mm-hmm. rice bowls, we have dumplings, you know, lots of different things on the menu that can kind of, you know, like, bring us into, like, more of like the Korean space as well, and not mm-hmm. just a fried chicken brand.
And I've looked at your work on social media, and the website is beautiful. I mean, the photography, everything's beautiful. It's Thank very well
you.
Done.
Thank you. Oh, that means a lot coming from you.
Well, I call it like I see it. I'm always honest about stuff like that. Thank so you. I think yeah, I really do
socials, but yeah.
I really do think you have something special. I mean that. I think it's a right. tremendous concept. So, like, if I may ask, how often do you visit Korea? When's the last time you've been there?
Oh, I was just there over the summer. Yeah. Okay. So I was there like for like 3 weeks in August.
Nice. And,
so I've got a ton of family there. I'd love to get back. Yeah, maybe in the fall. The summer's too hot, so we'll see. Mm-hmm.
Would you ever consider a Soulbird there?
Maybe. It's all about finding the right operator, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know, why bring sand to the beach?
That's
there are
true.
More Korean fried chicken shops in Korea than there are McDonald's in the world, so I don't know.
If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. It's like the New York thing, right?
Exactly, right? So, like, do I really want to go where
Well, I don't know. You're opening up how many restaurants at the same time now? I mean, you do a lot of things that are unorthodox, that's for sure.
It's true. Yeah. But these are
you have like two more opening now, right? Didn't you say?
I'm Madison Square Garden next week.
Uh-huh.
So we opened up Edinburgh. We opened up City Field last week. So that's done. And then hopefully in June, we might have some other new announcements. And then we'll see. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Which is great.
Yeah. So I guess I was going to say, is there any new locations on the horizon, but maybe you can't say.
Yeah. I never announce anything until after I sign the dotted line.
Gotcha. Well, hey, that's good.
Jinxing it. You know, like, you never celebrate a win.
That's right.
Until the clock's up. Right.
That's right. That's right. I truly respect that.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely. What about you? Are you still doing your work? So you have your TV show, you're still in the House of Knives.
Yeah.
What is your role there? Did you say you're a judge on that?
Yeah, I'm a part of the Culinary Council. So Marcus Samuelson and I pick apart the food with Scott Conant, who's the main host. And we just eat and get fat, basically.
I was going to say, is there a lot of prep or just go in there hungry? I mean,
we just go. Yeah, you can't eat anything. Like, there are all these like pre-judging things. Like, you can never eat anything, maybe a cup of coffee. And then you just eat all day, all day, all day, all day. And I have so much respect for those guys. Like, I love Scott, love Marcus. They really know like their trade. Like, I think we made a really good trio in terms of what we brought to the table. No pun intended.
Yeah. Do you ever have a situation where you, like, someone makes something, you're like, ugh, it's terrible?
Oh yeah, totally.
I mean,
yeah.
Like, just really, okay. Why are you here?
You try a lot of bad food also because it's not a competition of how well you can cook necessarily. It's a competition of how well you can cook under extraordinary circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
No time. And sometimes awful ingredients and awful mm-hmm. tools. You know, I mean, like, there are a lot of competitions where they give you like curling irons to cook with, and like while you're wearing lobster mitts, and you know, you have to cook with like gummy bears and mm-hmm. octopus and whatever, you know. So yeah. So we'll see.
That's great. So how do you see the global perception of Korean food evolving over the past several years in the future? I mean, do you think, you said that you did everything before like the K-pop, before all the Korean street. Is this something, trends are something that lasts for a while? Do you see this as a long-term trend?
I do. It's only growing. As long as like K-pop is still popular and the Korean dramas are still popular and, you know, now K-beauty is into this. I have so many friends going to Korea now as tourists. That yeah. never happened when I was growing up. Like, I have like, everyone is like, going to Korea. I'm going to Korea. I'm bringing my daughter. They're all bringing their kids because their kids are obsessed. Obsessed. Mm-hmm. It's like young teenagers, 20-something year olds, all obsessed with going to Korea. They all want to, you know, like eat the awesome. Food, everything. So it's amazing for me, especially because I've gone from being embarrassed about my lunchbox at school and one generation to like everybody like spamming me like, what are they eating in this? What are they drinking? What is that? And da da da. And, you know, and people and just the curiosity around Korean mm-hmm. food. It's like this cultural voyeurism, you know, and yeah, just having to like explain things. I guess it's like demystifying Korean cuisine for the masses. Yeah.
That's awesome. So you said you have a new book coming out, correct?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So this is my third book. It's called K-Quick. And it is Korean food in 30 minutes or less. So that's full and of it's full of tips and tricks from the pros like myself and my co-author, who my recipe developer and tester, who like we were like, can we do this? And at first I was like, oh my gosh, this is such a commercial book. But I have to say it was quite fun. And it's the first book where like literally all my friends are like, oh, I need to get this. I need to get this because nobody has time.
Right.
Nobody has time. And I was questioning, how are you going to get the flavor? How are we going to do this like without, you know, compromising on standards? But, you know, the great thing is that the grocery stores, like everything comes pre-chopped these days. You know, mm-hmm. you can buy so many things pre-chopped, pre-grated, everything. And they're pretty good quality, you know, so you can save a lot of time just by, you know, buying like a, you know, chopped bag of coleslaw mix, which is two different types of cabbage, mm-hmm. carrot, onion, and you throw that into any stir fry. And then you're kind of sorted and you're done. And, you know, just a few ingredients. And yeah, you can buy pre-chopped garlic, pre-chopped ginger. It's great. Yeah.
So what is in your refrigerator? Like you have, I mean, there's certain things with the Korean recipes. What are some of the things you must have? What are the must haves in the refrigerator?
And well, the dry pantry also, but gochujang, the fermented uh-huh. chili paste, doenjang, the fermented soybean paste, garlic and ginger for sure, soy mm-hmm. sauce, roasted sesame oil, mm-hmm. Mirin, always like some a little bit of apple juice or some form of sugar or honey would be great because there's always a bit of sweetness with all of the salt. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like a scattering of a handful of some other ingredients, but that's a great starting point.
Excellent.
Right
Excellent.
There. Yeah.
Now, if I'm going to Seoul Bird for the first time, because I have not, I said I had not been there, unfortunately, I will get to the one at Citi Field. So I'm going to go see a Phillies Mets game. So I will get to the one at Citi Field. But what do I get? What is the one thing I have to get? I'm having one meal.
Yeah, the Seoul Bird signature sandwich.
Can you describe that? What's it all about?
This is a Korean fried chicken tender. Mm-hmm. That's been battered in our special signature batter and coated in our sauce. And sandwiched in like a toasted brioche roll with lettuce, yes. tomato, and some Kewpie mayonnaise.
Well, that yeah. sounds fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I look forward to it. It's satisfying. S-E-O-U-L, satisfying. Yep. Yeah.
I get it. I see what you did there. That's awesome. But, you know, it's funny. Where do you get all your ideas? I mean, really, truly, I mean, this is a compliment. You have so many brilliant ideas, super on trend. Super marketable. Like, where does this come from? Do you just think these on your own all the time? Or are you just always contemplating with the brand?
Always thinking about things. I mean, every single meal I go out to eat, every single time I'm in a grocery store, you know, everywhere, like whenever I travel, you're constantly seeing new things, right? This huge source of inspiration is when you travel. Mm-hmm. I love traveling. So it's, I mean, like, and something with food, you can never learn it all, ever. Right. You know, there's always an ingredient, a spice or something that you've never seen or tried before. It's a truly fascinating and, you know, thought provoking. And, you know, I truly believe that also, you know, food tells the history of a country. So you can learn a lot about cultures and food and people through the food. Korea is a classic example of mm-hmm. it. You know, it tells a story of war and occupation and recession and everything just through what is popular in the country. Like Spam's still popular in Korea, and that's mm-hmm. because of the war. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of funny. You said you like traveling. So I guess you better, because most restaurateurs would open two restaurants maybe within a half hour of each other. You're Las Vegas, New York, and London. So
yeah.
A little bit of windshield time in between the stores.
definitely. But it's fun.
That's awesome. So I have one last question for you. It can't be soul, you know, anything from Soulbird. So, but if you had, and now of course, though, you did work in like the French Laundry and all these other phenomenal Michelin restaurants. So if you have one last meal, one final meal, what would you eat and why?
Okay. It would be a lot of different things and from all over the place. So I love sushi.
Okay.
So I probably do like a full omakase sushi experience with the works, like all the supplements, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? like the seared Wagyu, the chutoro, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. the caviar on top.
Fantastic.
Hokkaido scallops, you know, Santa Barbara uni, like all of that stuff. And then I love pizza. I love a great slice of pizza, like mushrooms on top, like mixed mushrooms. I'd love pizza. I probably also do like a big fiery bowl of sundubu jjigae, which is a Korean like silken tofu soup with kimchi and seafood in it. I do that with like a nice like pot of rice on the side of steaming white short grain white rice. And what else? God.
It's a very eclectic three-course meal you just
built. Oh, totally. Totally. I know. That's what I mean. It's like lots of different things. And I do love truffles. So I probably throw in there some like a truffled pasta, like a creamy truffled pasta with like a homemade tagliatelle and a nice, you know, like overindulgent truffle cream sauce.
I always go to the original Il Molino in New York, and they still do the best, the white truffle and just on the pasta. It's absolutely delicious.
Oh, gosh.
So, it's funny. You know, I read an article that you had been quoted in. I forget where it was, but you were talking about sushi and your favorite restaurant in New York. And I'm not kidding. I copied the name of it and I sent it to my daughter because she lives in New York. I said, next time we're in town, we're going there. And I forget the name of it offhand, but you had mentioned this is maybe your favorite. So,
was it Joji?
I think it was.
J-O-J-I. Yeah, I wrote about that one in the Financial Times.
Yeah.
No, I did an article for the Financial Times. I mentioned Joji. It is so good. You got to say hi to George. He's back there. So the funny story, which the FT cut out, okay, which I did include in the original article, but you know they're always editing things down. So it's spelled J-O-J-I with a bar over the O, Joji. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm expecting that this is some Japanese word and there's some deep symbolic meaning behind it, you know? So I'm asking the maitre d', like, okay, and I'm taking notes because I'm writing an article about this. I'm like, okay, so what does Joji mean? Like, what is it? And then he's like, Joji. And he points to the chef. He's like, Joji-san. George with an Asian accent.
That's awesome. Georgie. That's like, awesome.
Oh my God. But super cute, right?
That's awesome.
I was like, oh, Georgie-san. This is
That's great.
Yeah.
Very cool. Cute.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, G, you were fantastic. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed every minute of this.
Loved it. You know, thank you.
I wish you all the luck in the world. I mean, you got some really cool stuff going on. I can't wait to see this explode. I could see this certainly being a franchise concept because it's, like I said, you're hitting all the cues. And
it's
awesome.
You.
Congratulations.
Well, hopefully maybe I can hire you to help us with some marketing.
There you go. We would love that. Hey, that's what we do.
So I think you're too expensive for us though right now. So
you can pay us in chicken.
And chicken?
Yeah.
In time payment.
We work for food.
You work for food.
At Vigor, I mean, when you do restaurants, you work for food. So
Exactly. Chicken for you.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.